And our special guest this holiday week, Jim Marrs. We're going to talk about several major topics with Jim, including the Kennedy assassination, 9/11, and the alien agenda. Back with Jim Marrs in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Jim Marrs is an award-winning journalist, has more than 30 years' experience with several Texas newspapers. In 1999, he began teaching a course on UFOs, perhaps one of the first university-level UFO courses in the country. Jim has also investigated the U.S. Army's remote viewing program 3 years before it was publicly acknowledged by the CIA and then produced Alien Agenda. In addition, his book, Rule by Secrecy, has been termed an underground bestseller. He is our special guest on Coast to Coast. See, Jim, we couldn't get enough of you when you were at the conference in Las Vegas with Linda Moulton Howe. I had to get you back for a full show.
You betcha. There's just so much to talk about, and it's always good to be with you, George.
Indeed. Let's chat for a little bit, Jim, about the JFK assassination. You've done a lot of work in that arena, this being the 42nd anniversary of his death. I can't believe 42 years already. I mean, nearly half a century. Where has the time gone?
I can't believe it either, and especially in my case, because I've been teaching a course at the University of Texas at Arlington since 1976 on the assassination. And, of course, for many years there, fall and spring semester, I'm watching those newsreels all over again and watching those witnesses' testimony, and it just, you know, it's still fresh in my mind, and it's hard to conceive that that was, you know, pushing 50 years ago.
Now, was Rule by Secrecy one of your first books?
No, actually, my first book was Crossfire on the Kennedy assassination, because when I left the newspaper business down here in Texas, I tried to start my own, and if you think you don't make money working for a newspaper, try owning one. And then I decided, well, you know, I write, so what can I write about that people would want to know? And I'd been in contact with a bunch of the researchers in the Kennedy assassination arena, and I realized back in the 80s that there was a plethora of information about the Kennedy assassination that no one had really been exposed to. So I wrote Crossfire and accumulated all that, put it all together, put all the theories in there, put everything but the kitchen sink, and it just took off. And it's I'm very gratified because it's still valid today. There's virtually nothing that's come out since that book was published that in any way substantially changes the conclusions.
Of the various theories that you put out there, Jim, that you investigated, was there one that you continue to hold on to, the one that you think possibly is the one that truly happened on that horrible day in Dallas?
Well, yeah. In fact, I've been teaching that since 1976, and it hadn't changed since then. You have to understand that people, unfortunately, the news media, if and when they ever decide to address the research community in the Kennedy assassination, they tend to focus on the differences. People arguing over, you know, how many gunmen and from what locations and what were the trajectories. This is a bit like, you know, losing sight of the forest for looking at the trees. What you'd find, I think, is that by and large, almost everyone in the research community now has concluded that if Lee Harvey Oswald acted at all, and that's a big if, that he certainly didn't act alone. Well, therefore, by dictionary definition, we have a conspiracy. And most people now accept that. The latest polls show it's up around 85% of the population now believes that there was a conspiracy to kill President Kennedy. And in fact, the last official government pronouncement was from the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and they said, based on scientific evidence, that they was probably a conspiracy to kill Kennedy. But we don't know what that conspiracy was, and the federal government has declined to investigate further or to tell us what it was. And in my mind, that's what elevates what was legally a Texas homicide into a national coup d'etat.
Why at that time, Jim, did they want to keep that quiet? Were they afraid of widespread panic in this country if it was revealed that the president had been killed by a group of people within this country?
Right. I think it goes deeper than that, George. I think that by the fall of 1963, Kennedy was beloved by the general population, and his approval ratings were around 65%. And he looked to be a shoe-in for president in the 1964 election. But what most people were not aware of then, and most people aren't aware of now, is that he had managed to alienate and incur the intense hatred of some of the most powerful and violent factions in this country, namely this organized crime,
right?
The CIA, the FBI, the military-industrial complex, as General Eisenhower called it.
How about the Federal Reserve boys?
Of course. When he issued money in through the Treasury Department that we didn't have to pay interest on, that really capped it off. In fact, he became only the second president in the history of the United States to issue interest-free money. And the first one was Abraham Lincoln, who issued greenbacks to support the Civil War. And I don't think it's just a coincidence that both those men were shot in the head.
No, I think you're right, Jim. These episodes that Kennedy was part of, whether they were a combination of all of them or maybe just one major factor, there's no question that it was his undoing.
Right.
Didn't he realize that he was treading on dangerous ground when he was starting to upset the apple cart?
Yes, I believe he did. In fact, there was a very eerie home movie that Kennedy made where he grabs himself and rolls on the ground like he's been shot. And I think at another point he told someone, you know, if somebody wanted to kill me, it wouldn't be that difficult. You'd just have to get a guy with a rifle in a tall building. And, you know, that was pretty prescient. But, George, I have two tidbits of information that you and your listeners are probably not aware of that I think are extremely important in connection with this case. And if you allow me, I'd like to go through those two.
Absolutely, please.
Okay, the first has to do with computer models. excuse me. A couple of years ago, Peter Jennings on ABC produced a two-hour special on the Kennedy assassination and the big foundation of their conclusion that it was only one shooter from the Texas School Book Depository was based on this computer model. Other people have used computer models. There's even a game out that caused a lot of controversy about, you know, now you can shoot at President Kennedy.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, things like this. And they're all based on these computer models. And we've kind of gotten so used to computers now that we feel like, well, you know, the computer says this is the way it is. That's just the way it has to be. And yet, if you stop and think about it, we have to realize that a computer is no better than the information that's put into it. You know, the old adage, garbage in, garbage out. And so I want to point out that for any computer model to be 100% accurate, it's got to have 100% accurate data going into it, right? So to make a computer model of the Kennedy assassination, you would have to have 100% accurate information coming in dealing with the topography of Dealey Plaza, the distances, elevation, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to point out that years ago I interviewed Bob West, who was the Dallas County surveyor, and his associate Chester Brenneman on separate occasions. Now, these were the two men who were hired by the Warren Commission to survey Dealey Plaza in the spring of 1964. And the Warren Commission, back in their volumes, actually publishes a little postage-sized stamp of their map and a little legend, which gives all of this pertinent data. And to the best of my knowledge, this is the data that has been used by everybody from ABC to everyone else to base their computer models on. Now, here's the story. Both Bob West and Chester Brenneman very adamantly told me in no uncertain terms that the Warren Commission altered their numbers.
What?
Yes. And I can prove that because Chester Brenneman allowed me to copy his original survey map that they had done for the Warren Commission. And on there, by the way, in addition to altered numbers in their legend as when it was reproduced in the Warren Commission, there are also notations saying here's a bullet mark on the curb here and a bullet mark in the street here. And he said they were ordered to delete those. And the Warren Commission, of course, never showed us that. Now, I think, you know, what more can I say? Case closed.
That's a major story.
I think so, but of course nobody seems to pick up on that. But so I guess what I'm telling you and your audience is you cannot trust any computer model of the Kennedy assassination that is based on the data as published by the Warren Commission, period.
It's faulty.
It's faulty. And if you're off, you know, on something like that, if you're off as much as an eighth of an inch somewhere, it'd be, you know, it's going to be 30, 40 feet out somewhere else. So you just can't trust those. Now, the second thing is, and nobody knows about this because this took place in Japan, and the only reason I know about it is because I happened to be involved in their documentary a couple of years ago, again, about the same time that Peter Jennings presented his ABC documentary on the Kennedy assassination. There was a 2 to 3 hour documentary produced in Japan for one of their television networks, Asahi. And they came over and interviewed me and a lot of other people. And they, too, did a computer model. And just to show you how screwy it can get with the computer models, in this documentary, they went to Poland and computer experts in Poland. They went to computer experts at Scotland Yard. They studied all the data, and they concluded that there were at least 4 shooters shooting.
Oh, my God.
Okay?
4?
So see what happens? But one of the items that they brought out in this Japanese documentary blew me away, and I think it will you, too. They first sent me a copy of their documentary in Japanese, and I thought what I was seeing was what I was seeing, but since it was in Japanese and I don't speak Japanese, I wasn't certain. But then later they sent me an English translation, and sure enough, here's the story.
All right.
They found a man in California who had been a friend of Jim Garrison's, the DA in New Orleans, that prosecuted Clay Shaw, and had obtained from Jim Garrison a clean, pristine copy of the Zapruder film,
Which we have not seen.
We did not for 15 years. Okay, and in fact, would not have seen it maybe even today if it had not been for Jim Garrison. He subpoenaed the film from Time Life. They fought it, I believe, all the way to the Supreme Court. And they said, no, this is a legitimate subpoena. You have to turn over the film. And that's how it became available, because once Jim Garrison had it, some of his people made copies, other people made copies, they made copies of the copies, and it finally was released to the American public.
He had the originals, Jim, original?
He subpoenaed them, and it's my understanding he got a second or third generation copy. But with all the frames in it.
Right.
Now, for any of those of you who have seen the Zapruder film, or you may own a copy of the Zapruder film, including the latest DVD that's supposed to be the retouched, refurbished,
enhanced version,
you will clearly see a splice that takes place just as Kennedy disappears behind the Stimmons Freeway sign, just as the shots were being fired, but some frames before the fatal headshot. And you will see that he's sitting on the edge of the car, his right hand's up, he's waving, he's kind of looking to his right, everything seems to be okay. And by the time he emerges from behind the Stimmons Freeway sign, he's hands are clutching to his throat, And it's clear that he is showing some stress and that he has been hit by about at least a bullet. Now, the splice appears just as he goes behind the sign. We've known about this for years, but we didn't understand. I think Time Life tried to explain that this was the film was damaged in processing. And we knew there was a frame or two or so missing there.
Right.
But nobody knew why, okay? My suspicion was that they had simply edited out a couple of three frames just to tighten up the time sequence to try to make the three shots in the 5.6 seconds work.
Okay.
But no. The Japanese, when they got this Zapruder film that did not have the splice, found something quite different, and then it was confirmed when they went to a fellow in Dallas, and he too had an unspliced version of the Zapruder film, and it confirmed what they had found there, and that is the frames that are missing are the frames that show a bullet striking the sign. One frame, the back of the sign is totally clear, and the next frame, bam, there's a little bullet hole in it.
And George, this
is confirmed by the witnesses that there. Several of the witnesses said they thought a bullet hit the sign. But we'll never be able to prove this because sometime, either before or shortly after the year 1964 began, someone took that sign down. It disappeared and has never been seen since. And we have checked with the Dallas Street Department and with the Texas Highway Department, and they said they're the only ones who legitimately could be handling that sign, and they said, we did not take it down.
And that would have at least confirmed then what? Two possible shooters?
What it would confirm is there's another shot.
Yes.
Okay, now the House Committee said there were four, and this bullet strike on the sign makes it five. And, of course, I think most of the researchers would concur that there's actually more than that because Gene Hill saw a bullet strike the pavement in the street just ahead of the car. And in fact, Sheriff Decker said the same thing. He saw a bullet kick up dust and concrete in the middle of the street. So there's six shots. Okay.
And it was hard enough to believe that Oswald got three off.
Exactly. Three shots from one rifle in 5.6 seconds is pushing it to the limit. Most people haven't even really accepted that. But, they've tried for years to prove that that's possible. And I think the latest attempt was about a year ago that aired on the Discovery Channel from some guys down in Australia. And they got the same type rifle, but they put a modern scope on it, and they got it on a tower, and they taped it to where it was absolutely steady, and then they got these two body forms filled with gelatin and positioned them just the way they thought they ought to be, and they said, see, we can show that one bullet could pass through these two men, and that, of course, is true, but even they could not duplicate the shot that they said Oswald did.
In 1960 technology, Jim, how would this have been done? Let's say they had that triangular chute, three people.
Right.
Would they have been hooked up with some kind of radio or walkie-talkie and somebody said, go, and then they all fire at the same time?
I think that's exactly right. I think that, in fact, we had a man who came forward during the Garrison investigation and claimed that he was one of the radio operators. And we've also got a picture of a man that appears to be holding a walkie-talkie type device up to his head. This was came to be known as the dark-complected man who was standing there by the stem and sign. And just as Kennedy passed, he raises his fist, his right fist, up in the air. And a lot of people have suspected that he was some sort of visual signal man, you know, signaling that more shots were needed. And then he sits down on the curb, places something up to his face, and you can see a wire and antenna sticking out from behind his head. And, of course, if they use radios, then we don't have three shots. We have three volleys.
Exactly. Stay with us, Jim. When we come back, let's talk about a motive for the assassination. And some of the things that Jim will tell you may shock you. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Now, remember, we're going to have a live program for you on Thanksgiving night. So after you have gorged yourself on turkey, just sit back, try to stay awake, because we're going to have a live coast-to-coast program for you on Thanksgiving. The clock is ticking for the free Art Bell interview CD with the late Father Malachi Martin called Perfect Possession. It is a great gift, and it's part of the After Dark newsletter. You get that when you subscribe or renew. As a matter of fact, the January issue of the After Dark newsletter will highlight some well-known psychics, some of your favorites. But you can get that CD while the offer is still there when you subscribe or renew to the After Dark newsletter by simply calling 1-888-727-5505 or go online at Coast2TO, coasttocoastam.com. Jim, in your opinion, what was the motive for the assassination of Kennedy? We've heard all different kinds of stories. I'd like to get your thoughts.
I've been asked before to give the motive in 25 words or less, so I would have to say that Kennedy was shaking up the status quo, and the status quo struck back.
And did they all get together collectively, do you think? Or do you think it was that one facet of the status quo that he pushed a little too far?
Well, you know, for years the researchers were kept divided and squabbling with each other over, you know, was it the military, was it the CIA, was it the FBI, was it the anti-Castro Cubans?
Was it the mob?
Was it the mob? And the answer is yes. Okay, and how can I say that? Because Operation Mongoose. Operation Mongoose was the secret war against Castro. It was run by General Edwin Lansdale and out of the University of Miami. And here we see a confluence of CIA, anti-Castro Cubans, the mob, the military, and there they all are, and carrying out all kinds of nefarious plots, including assassination attempts on Castro. So what's the big deal? They sent a hit team to Dallas.
How could they keep it secret for so long, Jim?
Well, because that was condoned, or at least looked the other way by the true rulers of this country, the moneyed elite. Okay, Bill Moyers calls it the shadow government.
I call it the Illuminati.
The Committee of 300, whatever, Wall Street, the people who run the country. And when you look at it, there has been some really excellent work done by Professor Donald Gibson, who shows that the Warren Commission, the genesis of the Warren Commission, was not actually the idea of Lyndon Johnson, but of ranking members of the Council on Foreign Relations. And, of course, the people who surrounded Lyndon Johnson, who succeeded Kennedy, his so-called wise men that included Dean Rusk and Dean Acheson and Averell Harriman and on, they were all members of the Council on Foreign Relations. And the Council on Foreign Relations, in their publication Foreign Affairs, just after World War II, had published several papers saying that we, meaning the United States, needed to gain control over the mineral resources of Southeast Asia. And this, of course, was the genesis and the whole purpose and agenda of the Vietnam War. And in fact, in 1954, when the French were defeated in what was then French Indochina, and they pulled out, that was just within months, John Foster Dulles, who was Secretary of State under Eisenhower and a founding member of the Council on Foreign Relations, went to the Philippines, created the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, which he later said was just to give the American president a legal pretext for intervention in Southeast Asia. So they wanted this war. The military-industrial complex wanted the war. The CIA wanted the war. Everybody wanted the war, but except maybe Kennedy. And Kennedy was taking steps, tentative steps, admittedly, and to disengage from that war.
And Has every president, Jim, with the exception of Carter, because I think he was a pretty decent guy, maybe too nice, quite frankly.
That's why he's only a one-term president.
Yeah, exactly.
But grab this.
Yeah.
In 1979, they were getting ready to come into the election year of 1980, and all the media was pushed along by their corporate masters to tell us how wishy-washy Carter was. And so in the late spring of 1979, Carter had asked for some national TV time, and they were saying he was probably going to announce some sweeping changes and new initiatives for his administration. But he went to Los Angeles for a Cinco de Mayo celebration, and while there, very little mentioned in the media, there was an assassination plot. And they arrested a Anglo man with a blank starter pistol and 70 rounds of blank ammunition. And then he pointed out a Hispanic man, and they arrested him, charged both of them with attempted assassination of the President of the United States. And Jimmy Carter then canceled his nationwide TV talk, went into seclusion at Camp David, and was reported as saying that he had lost control of the government.
Oh,
now,
my God.
Now, grab this. The Anglo man was Raymond Lee Harvey, and the Spanish man was Oswaldo Ortiz.
Oh, you got to be kidding
so
me.
So Lee Harvey and Oswaldo were arrested for trying to assassinate President Carter, and he quickly backed off of everything. And does that not sound a lot like what happened to Ross Perot?
Yes.
Who looked like he was really getting some momentum going to run for president, and then all of a sudden he drops out saying that he feared for the safety of his family. You know, one of the Warren Commission members said while they were debating, you know, whether they were going to have a real investigation or whether they were going to just try to come up with some scenario that would pacify the American public. One of the Warren Commission members said, yeah, the thing we have to prove is that America is not just another banana republic. But unfortunately, I guess we are just another banana republic.
You know, and it's a strange situation, Jim, because we have the appearance that we have, as Americans, tremendous freedoms here, and more than most countries. But when you really think about it, we don't. We are force-fed the candidates. They are truly pushed and promoted. You know, those who get the money behind them are truly the ones who get the limelight. So the good president, the average guy, for example, with no money, who might be the best leader of all of them, he doesn't get to the forefront at all.
He doesn't have a chance.
He doesn't have a chance at all, especially nowadays. So to me, I mean, yesterday I was talking with a guest about China 2 days ago, and we talk about the fact that maybe 1,000 people run that entire country,
right,
and they've all raped, robbed, and pillaged the resources and the finances. You know, I think
the only difference, George, is that I've been to China, and most of those people in China realize that they don't have any control, and they have to do what they're told. Over here, most Americans think that they're free and they get to go vote, you know. But look at the 2004 election. You could vote for rich oil man skull and bones member Bush, or you could vote for rich oil man skull and bone member John Kerry. So
what the heck?
Right. We laughed at the Russians back during the communist era, because when they had presidential elections, they had one name on the ballot, okay? Well, you know, we get two names, but they're both run by the same bunch.
So they throw us a little congressional election every once in a while,
right,
and we feel as if we're putting those candidates in the Senate. We are putting them in Congress, and we've got some control that way, but we really don't. I think if Americans really understood what was going on, and again, I like to use the phrase, the Illuminati, the group that benefits, we are being forced and dictated to, and we have the appearance of freedom, But honestly, in this, and I'm talking about not the country, I'm talking about the government. There's a big difference.
Right.
We really don't have the kind of freedom that we think we do.
No, we don't. In fact, I've traveled pretty widely around the world, and I guarantee you in many, many other countries, including highly socialized countries like, say, Sweden or Finland Australia is pretty socialistic, and they have much more freedom than we do on an individual basis. Now, you mentioned the Illuminati. Let me point out to your listeners that a lot of people think the Illuminati is some sinister, shadowy organization, and it may be. There was a Bavarian Illuminati couple hundred years ago, and it may not have actually died out. But my point is that saying someone is Illuminati would be like saying they are a Nazi, or saying that they are a communist, or saying that they are a Republican or a Democrat. These are ideologies, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So you can't just run around looking for somebody with a black cloak and a bomb in his hand and say he's Illuminati. It is a theology, it is a movement, it is a philosophy, and at the heart of some of these philosophies that I feel like are negative, perhaps even evil, is the basic foundation is the old thing about the end justifies the means.
Good
okay?
point.
And so if someone is practicing the end justifies the means, then they are, in effect, practicing Illuminati theology.
This country runs on the apparent free capitalism within it. What happens, Jim Mars, when that starts to slow down? General Motors announcing they're going to lay off and eliminate 30,000 people to save $7 billion. That could be just the beginning. If this economy really starts to slow down, the economy that this country has been based on, what happens then when we have a country divided by the haves and the have-nots?
Right. That's going to put us in a very terrible position, because throughout history, when you have a handful of haves trying to lord it over a great multitude of have-nots, inevitably you will have a revolution.
And that's what's scary about all of this.
Yeah, it's exactly what's scary. And that's why I holler and scream and try to get people to pay attention and try to get things changed now, when at least they're paying lip service to the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, instead of waiting until we're under an absolute police state and then have to actually have a violent fight trying to regain our freedoms.
Could it be because these people in power, who are very clever, very smart, may think, and they may be looking down road, and they may be saying, look, we're going to have problems with this separation. That's why we need to start whittling away rights now. That's why we may need to be able to force them to take vaccines. We may want to be able to quarantine them. We better get everything in place before it's too late.
That's absolutely correct, and that's why over the past 4 or 5 years you have seen an intensification of the efforts to strip away our constitutional freedoms and to set up the framework for essentially martial law. We heard President Bush has already said that in the event of the outbreak of some, you know, big epidemic or whatever, that we're going to have to turn to the military to tell us what to do and how to do it and where to go and where to live and who's going to take vaccines. And, you know, and yet those vaccines have proven ineffective at best and downright dangerous at worst. I would point out that after the first Gulf War, you know, we had such a terrible number of our soldiers over there that came down with what finally was called the Gulf War Syndrome. And I would point out that a division of French troops refused to take our inoculations and vaccinations, and they did not have one reported case of Gulf War Syndrome.
I am told that most health practitioners are themselves refusing to take certain vaccines.
Exactly. And the thing is, here's the bottom line, George. It should be an issue. It's not an issue of vaccines. It's an issue of freedom, because they already are setting the laws into place to force you to take a vaccination. And I'm sorry, but in a free country, you should be able to say, I don't want to take the vaccination. All right? And if you don't, then that's your own lookout. If that's a wrong decision, then that's something you'll have to live with. But I don't see in a free country where the state has the right to come and tell you what you're going to inject into your body.
Has this erosion of rights, Jim, been occurring since the Kennedy assassination, or has it been going on ever, you know, for since the beginning of time?
Oh, George, you know as well as I do, when you have people that seek power, they always work to gain more power and just consolidate the power that they have. So I think in a general way, it's been kind of pushing along for a long time. I think it really got moving in this country under Franklin Roosevelt, a Democrat, I might point out. But then he had to deal with the Depression, and they came up with lots of programs that some were good and some were not so good. I think the WPA, the Works Project Administration, was probably a pretty good program because the government was paying a lot of people to work, and that saved them from starvation. And in the end result was we got bridges and highways and buildings, and, you know, we got something out of it. That's better than what we do today, paying people welfare. You know, they don't work, and we pay them anyway.
I think they should all work. If they want to get a check from the government, they should be out there picking up paper in highways. I don't care what it is, but
exactly.
They should be working.
Exactly, and look what would happen, George. Think about the normal human response to something like that. You say, "Wow, I got it made, man! I can go work for the government. And I can lean on my shovel for all day, and I can get minimum wage." But after a couple of weeks of that, and you look around and you go, "Gee, I'm just leaning on my shovel, but I'm only getting minimum wage, maybe I ought to do something."
So exactly.
Then they start shoveling, and pretty soon they're shoveling, and pretty soon they figure out, well, heck, I'm shoveling for minimum wage. Maybe I ought to go get a job with a construction company, and I could still be shoveling, but I get a lot more money.
Or let me go back to school and get a new trade.
Yeah, I go learn how to drive that forklift or something, you know, and get me a better paying position. I bet you'd get people off the rolls pretty quick. There's so many things that we could be doing. For example, Willie Nelson down here in Texas has built a biodiesel plant.
He was on with Art a few months ago talking about that, but I think that's a great idea.
Exactly. So look at this. Right now we're paying some of the farmers in this country millions and millions of tax dollars not to plant crops because they don't want to drive the prices down in the agriculture arena. Okay, well, fine. Let's just stop that. Let all the farmers grow all the crops they want to. That's their profession. That's what they want to do. And any crops they can't sell at a fair price on the agriculture market, let the government buy it and turn it into biodiesel.
Exactly.
But that's too simple, isn't it?
Yeah, in Missouri, in a plant, this is their time of year, they use turkey parts for fuel. they dump them into all these machines, and they come out with all kinds of fuel. It's amazing.
That's true. That's true. When Mr. Diesel invented the diesel engine back about the turn of the 20th century, he designed that engine to run on vegetable oil or animal fat. But obviously somebody didn't like that. That's why he mysteriously fell overboard while crossing the English Channel.
Isn't that
And right after that, they shifted over the diesel engine to run on petrochemicals. And we're only now, you know, a century later, finally getting around to run those diesel engines on biodiesel, vegetable oil, or animal fat.
You've changed your website. You've got some spiffy graphics on it now.
Oh, yeah, jimmars.com. I try to keep all kinds of stuff going up there. And I'm trying to keep people posted on stories that they might not catch in the mainstream media. You know, a lot of people are always saying, well, you're just a conspiracy theorist. And no, not really. It's just that if you want the conventional wisdom, you know, tune into the major networks. They'll give you the mainstream news. I try to tell people the news that they don't seem to be able to get otherwise, just like you, George.
Jim, stay with us. Next hour, I want to talk with you about the alien agenda, and I don't mean those people who are flooding over the border. I'm talking about those upstairs, way upstairs.